For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. If you go to MobiusStripPress.com, you can find out how you can download these podcasts and find our support documents and links. This is also an educational and grassroots program designed to restoring our republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the framework and scope of the Constitution. Many parts of these shows will refer to previous shows, and these shows build off of each other. Consequently, to keep up, you'll need to listen to all of these shows to garner what Republic Review is and how you can help in reclaiming the Republic. Don't forget, you can download these podcasts at reclaimingtherepublic.org. Well, let's talk about birthdays. First off and foremost, it's my brother's birthday, so happy birthday, brother. And secondly, last week we actually had a caller call in and identify the correct answer to my question, which was what for us is the most significant of November 11th, and that is Washington State's birthday. It's when they became stakeholders in the Constitution. Well, over the past couple of days, and actually since the beginning of the year, you've probably not heard the state of Georgia, Alaska, Utah, New Mexico, Connecticut, Michigan, Kansas, Oregon, Arizona, Massachusetts, or Ohio, Nebraska, and Florida, or Vermont celebrating their birth in the Union by joining into this republic and becoming stakeholders in the Constitution. And that's really unfortunate. And that's one of the things that we need to start focusing on. And that's one of my focuses, is trying to get the public more constitutionally attuned and understanding the state's role and responsibility in the Constitution. So understanding when they became a stakeholder is paramount. Today is the day Maine became a stakeholder in the Union, March 15th. So let it be known that if you look in the news and check the newspapers in Maine, you probably won't find the jubilee and the celebrations going on in the streets that they became stakeholders. And that's sad, because the responsibility that states have in this Union is, I'm at a loss of words, because they are the overseers of that general government. And because they've been sleeping at the wheel, we're living with such a level of federal tyranny that people can't even fathom what we're dealing with. I mean, as I tell people that 80% of the government is unconstitutional, they look at me like, are you kidding me? That's how long we've been asleep at the wheel. So that's how important it is that we get back to that. And how do we get back to that? We have to build off of each other. I'm going to use two words that millennials hate: symbiosis and synergy. The progressives have been incredibly successful over the several decades in becoming very successful because they've used symbiosis and they've built synergy amongst themselves by building a loyalty and getting people to come in. And they've colluded with others. I mean, there's been plenty of evidence where the progressives or these big corporations have colluded in trying to take advantage of the little guys by using government and so forth. There have been some really good corporations out there. Alcoa is one of them. There's some really good companies that have done historically, have bent over backwards for their workers and their customers and so forth. And that's great. That's great for business. But when somebody goes and tries to get an advantage by using government, and I'll give you a great example. in the 90s, early 90s, maybe it was the late 80s, Bill Gates started going to the government and getting the government to use Microsoft Office instead of using all of these different word processing programs. And he gave them this huge break. It was very similar to what Jobs did. Jobs started putting computers out in schools. And by doing this, he created a loyalty to where people didn't want to have to deal with converting files from WordPro, WordStar, or all of these other different word processing programs. We all just use the same. And they created standards. Nothing wrong with standards. If standards are established by one's own research and, you know, thoroughness and vetting and so forth, then that's fine. But when somebody colludes and says, you know, I'm going to give you this break, and that's how they get in the door, then to me, that's not the same as good, honest, hard work and, you know, competing with everybody. And that's actually taking advantage of either access or your competitors and so forth. So anyway, regarding loyalty, I believe that as you start listening to people that are on the radio station that are advertising, speaking, or what have you, I think it's incumbent on all of us to try to buy those products from those people who are advertising. We need to buoy each other up and help us build mutually benefiting relationships, symbiosis, so that we can start working together and doing more synergy with the sum of our gains or the total of our capacity. So we can actually do a lot more than what we seem to be capable of doing. And so that's what the progressives have been doing. And they throw money out left and right towards all of their little causes. I mean, it's pretty sad when Soros has been able to employ people for $1,500 a week for protesting in the streets and so forth. And what do you want to bet that $1,500 isn't taxed and it's probably under the table? And again, you know, it's all nefarious work and it's all undermining us. So that's why we need to start working, and we need to start working together through loyalty and saying these people identify with my ideology, my ideals. And as such, I need to spend, you know, it cost me $2 more to go and buy it from this guy than buying it on Amazon. That $2 is worth it. Anyway, one other thing I wanted to point out before I really get into the constitutional amendments and so forth is I found it interesting that last week's caller was from California. And so I just wanted to point out that George's books are on his way and he ought to have his hands on them probably by the end of the week. And I appreciate him calling and even listening from there. And don't be afraid if I have a contest and it seems like you really don't know, but you can take a stab at it, I will usually help you. And if you're not driving and you can do a Google interview or what have you, by all means, then you give it a little bit extra chance to try again and see if you can come up with the right answer. So moving into this week's constitutional look at recent events, it seems to be that socialized medicine continues to be the center stage, with the CBO weighing in on this new bill that they're facing. And it seems to me that we have to keep into context those people that are a part of the CBO are the same people that the Bush administration, the Obama administration has put in. More importantly, I think the information and the way they look at bills is very myopic. They only look at it in a certain way as to what this is going to cost. What they never do is provide the analysis that if we don't do the bill altogether, how would that affect the economy if we got rid of socialized medicine? Because there's no doubt in my mind that we could bring prices down, we could actually be far more effective and far more efficient in our healthcare systems if we got government completely out of the way. But they don't seem to be able to take that type of a perspective. And so we seem to be trapped in what's good for government and how they can maybe make them better. And that's always at our expense. So let's put aside the unconstitutionality of socialized medicine for just a second. What would happen if we did and we actually unregulated the healthcare system? And we got rid of the bureaucracy that has been woven into our government since Ike stepped on the Constitution by signing the bill that instituted the Department of Health and Education and Welfare on April 11th, another anniversary's coming up, in 1953. What would happen? We would probably go right back to those same great institutions that provided health care in the first place. What are those big institutions? I mean, when you think of a great hospital in your local community, one would probably not think of, I'm just trying to think of a good secular entity. And so give me a second as we go into these breaks, and I'll have a secular entity for us when we get back. Stay tuned. You will find consistent advice among financial advisors, conservative entertainers, preppers, and those who have legitimate concern about our currency and our government. They all recommend holding precious metals in some way and degree for varying reasons. I, too, recommend precious metals, especially holding it in your possession in a secure storage system for several reasons. One, it can protect you from the inflation of a fiat currency. Two, some coins can be used in bartering in an absolute emergency. And three, this is a good way to pass wealth down to your posterity. If you're looking to add precious metals to your portfolio or to your holdings, I would like to show you how you can get these metals for less than how I can get them. You heard that correct, for less than how I can get them. And I believe you cannot beat this price. Let me explain. My broker's company has, I believe, the lowest set price for all metals on the market. And just like all other precious metal companies, they offer commission to those who refer others, which most times this affects the bottom line price. Well, my broker's company does not adjust the price. They have a flat buy and selling price. And I have worked it out with my broker to take a portion of my commission to offer you a discount to let you save money on your purchases for slightly lower than the price, than the selling price that I get them for. It may be a slight discount, but a discount nonetheless. If you're interested in buying physical metals at the lowest price and learning more about this deal, contact me via email at metals, with an S at the end, at reclaimingtherepublic.org. And I will introduce you to my broker, and he can give you the pricing and how you will actually pay less than me. Again, that's metals, M-E-T-A-L-S, at reclaimingtherepublic.org. Thank you. All right, so we're back, and I just realized why I really can't think of a really good secular institute or institution or so forth, and that's really because it's not really one. I don't think that there's a George Soros Institute. I mean, he funds all sorts of organizations that are designed to, you know, do a very specific thing, but there's no... It's not like the converse of what I was going to get to. And if we think about the birth of our great healthcare system, you know, you have to think of those great institutions like Mount Sinai or the St. Jude's, St. Mary's, St. Joseph's. You can get my point. Our great healthcare system was brought to us by the compassionate services of these great religious institutions. And so in the secular society, they were unable to compete with that, nor did they even want to. What they wanted to do was they wanted to take control of that. So this new wave of socialism that actually began under Truman, or even further back to Teddy Roosevelt, when he started getting into socializing businesses with his trust busters and socializing parks and so forth by taking state property and making national parks and all of that, that's all unconstitutional. So when Eisenhower was inaugurated in January, this new wave of socialism, of healthcare, began. Even though it seemed kind of innocuous to what he did, Instead of vetoing this unconstitutional bill, Eisenhower signed it, and it placed us on a path of destroying what was, at the time, the best healthcare system in the world, and relegated it to becoming a costly and burdensome system in less than half a century. Bear in mind that it was Johnson and his Great Society concept that was actually colluding with insurance companies, and it was they who were responsible for inserting government's tentacles into the system even deeper, which was the beginning of the ramping up of the cost of healthcare and ramping up the profits for these insurance companies as they pulled private and even religious institutions under this unconstitutional government oversight and regulations. One should see how insidious this process has been as the gradual ratcheting of tyranny has been placed upon us. And the metaphor of boiling the frog is very apt for this. The only way we can have the best healthcare system possible is eliminating the federal government's involvement altogether and release it back to the free market, to the states and the institutions that are in the business of compassionate service. Granted, I understand that the secular progressives will holler bloody murder, because they will either have to go to a church hospital or a subpar community service, such as a secular ran one. You do understand that secular progressives want to make everyone pay via the force of government so that they can have a decent system because of their ideology. They are void of true compassion and being thy brother's keeper. Let them create their own compassionate service institution for the godless instead of trying to step on and oppress those who choose to worship. It seems that this debasement of our society is more about making secular progressives feeling better about themselves than it is about the individual and God-given right to religious expression. There is a metaphor in the form of a story about a camel and a tent that deserves sharing. If you haven't heard the metaphor or the story about the camel and the tent, the camel is outside in a windstorm and the camel owner is inside his tent, and the camel's out there crying because this windstorm is just whipping up the sand and beating this poor camel. And he cries and says, "Master, let me at least get my nose in so I can breathe fresh air and not have to deal with this sharp jades and shards of sand cutting into my nose." And so the master feels compassionate for the camel and allows him to put his nose in. Well, the next thing he says is, "Well, Master, I can't even open my eyes. Let me at least get my head in so that I can open my eyes because the sand is just cutting at my face." And the master again is compassionate and allows the head to come in. And before you know it, now that that head is in, the camel starts using his force and basically takes over the tent and pushes the master out of the tent. The intent was never just to get the nose in or the eyes in. The camel wanted to be in that tent, and he sought compassion upon the master to allow him to do this. And again, there's some truth in that metaphor of to what we've been allowing the progressives to do, and we don't have to do that. When people talk about a little compassion, it is not compassion they are seeking. They are seeking to take everything from you and to control you. The most compassionate thing one can do is to help someone become self-sufficient. If the intent of any compassionate assistance or program is to create a safety net or simple assistance to make it easy for somebody to just be able to come and tap that and be able to get assistance, then what you've created is actually a tool to enslave those people needing help. Self-reliance is the only way. And self-reliance for all who possess the capacity must be self-sufficiency, and that must be our goal. Again, if one is looking for answers, you are listening to the only program that has the courage to discuss the real and only solutions to save our liberties and our society. So now let's take a look into the future regarding our constitutional crisis, and only one little facet that I've been focusing on for the past 4 weeks now. Trump's new travel ban is now facing more challenges in the court. As I've said this last week, the Constitution was not surrendered to the court for interpretation, and I provide this with, and I've proved this, with the citations of the ratification, not the ratification debates, the Federalist Papers from Hamilton 78. I think it was paragraph 17. But you can go back and listen to that. The Constitution was also well-defined during this ratification process. I'm going to have some of those as well to help support this, but I'm just trying to focus on one set of documents at a time. This interpretation stuff is what lawyers and judges want you to believe, giving lawyers, judges, politicians, and bureaucrats the sole responsibility over the Constitution makes them the keepers of thought. This is why reading the authors of the Constitution's testimony during the ratification debates and the Federalist Papers is paramount for everyone to understand the hard limitations placed upon the federal government within the Constitution. It was the lawyers and judges and politicians who created the concept of constitutional law. And I know I've said this before. What we have is a contract as to who does what. And if someone wants to do more, there is a process for them to be granted the ability to do more. The lure of self-aggrandizing one's role at the expense of our liberties and sovereignty must end. There's all sorts of insidious organizations that, from some noble intent, they step forward, they get created. Unions are one of those organizations because they'll never step back. They want to maintain and self-aggrandize. They had a role. They probably still have a role, but they won't step back into the proper role that they need to be in because it's not like we're working on dirt floors anymore, folks. Let today be the beginning of the paradigm shift. So join me in convincing the states to do their job and reel in this federal tyranny. The solution is simple, and even though I have said this for weeks, for I think since the beginning of the show, since February 1st, it is necessary that it be repeated that Trump must call upon Congress to exercise their authority to bring the court back into the framework and scope of the Constitution, just as I am submitting that the states do the same to the federal government by using a convention for republic review or auditing the contract. Well, I'm coming up on a break, so I ask you to please hang in there, stay tuned, and we'll be right back after some of our sponsors. And please support our sponsors. Thank you so much. Okay, so as I was just stating, that it is the same thing I've been submitting for this entire show, and the whole point of reclaiming the republic has been getting the states to do their job in protecting us from federal tyranny. So that's where we left off. It is time for those with the authority to exercise their authority before we lose our individual liberty and sovereignty, our Constitution, and our republic. To help support my assertion that we're living under federal tyranny and that the court has gone completely awry and that we must reel the courts back in and getting Trump to do the Judiciary Act or a new Judiciary Act to re-scope and put them back into the framework of the Constitution, I'm going to have a guest come on next week who wrote a book called Believe, and his name's Mark Urbach. And we're going to talk about how the secular progressive agenda was used through the liberal courts throughout the past century and how the judges made their rulings to change the landscape of our republic and the mores of our republic by debasing it and removing God as often as they possibly could from schools and our civil systems and so forth. So Mark and I are going to talk about the facts and the necessity of reeling in the courts And we're going to also talk about my thesis of Republic Review. I've asked Mark, every guest I bring on, they're going to at least read my thesis of Republic Review, the irrefutable argument. And I will get them to, you know, give me their input. Am I out to lunch here or what? And so we'll find out if I'm out to lunch. Who knows? GR may be just that crazy guy you're listening to. But maybe not. But anyway, we're going to have him on, and we will probably talk about his book first, then my thesis, and then we'll get into a dialogue regarding the, you know, the reeling in and a judiciary act of pulling the federal court system and the courts themselves back into the framework of the Constitution. So this is the exciting part of the show where I get to actually read. And so before I get into reading these citations, let me ask, are the words in these founding documents that I am citing here today, which were clearly documented, the words of deceit? Or are the words that we have been taught from our progressive education system, the progressive colleges and professors, lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats, the words of deceit? Who can we trust? What is the truth as to how is our Constitution defined? And so with that, let me kind of quickly go over what we covered last week. Last week, I covered a portion of Federalist Paper number 78. Again, it was talking about the courts, and I was right. It was paragraph 17. And it is the quote that stands out is the uncommon portion of fortitude in the judges to do their duty as faithful guardians of the Constitution and not point guards for trying to score for the opposition of the Constitution. Since it's basketball season, I thought I'd put a little basketball spin to it. That's it. I'm not going to do any more. Anyway, a compact. So the next thing we went over last week is a compact between independent sovereigns, or a contract between independent sovereigns, is absolved and void when any portion of that contract is violated. So the Constitution, easily, the states could easily just step up and you go, you've so violated that it's done. But I don't think we want to get rid of that document and the edifice that the framers created. What we need to do is get the federal government back into compliance, as I've been saying. That was Federalist Paper 43, paragraph 30. The next one was the ambitious encroachments of the federal government should cause plans of resistance by the entire republic. That's Federalist Paper number 46, paragraph 7 from Madison. This is all powerful stuff. And they're talking about, you know, how do they deal with this? They saw this stuff, that there could easily be these problems. Well, this is what you got to do. Again, the boiling the frog, it took them a century and all of these things to become obscure that everybody would forget about it, to where they really started taking advantage. And when did we really start gaining access to these founding documents, like the ratification debates? The first attempt in trying to resurrect the ratification debates was in 1976, and the University of Wisconsin created a DHRC, the DHRC, and it's the documentation history of the ratification debates of the Constitution. And what they did was they started pulling in all the newspapers, all the arguments, and all the documents out of all the 13 states, and partway through this process, they kind of said, you know, this is kind of looking bad because it looks like the states really have more power than we want them to know. And so it's kind of taken the back seat. Now, you can still go on to the University of Wisconsin and find some of this information, and they'll be happy to provide it for you. But this stuff should have been front page news, right? This was on the heels of the counterculture revolution when the progressives were winning and had taken over so much. EPA was already created. The Department of Education was just around the corner. Department of Energy was just around the corner. The controls of almost everything were in place. You get my point? Anyway, the other thing I covered last week was that the state governments generally possess the confidence and goodwill of the people and will be effectually oppose or will be able to effectually oppose all encroachments of the national government. And so what happened? How come we haven't been doing this? And again, one of those old premises, it's an adage, knowledge is power. People just don't know. So we can't assert the power of that knowledge until we actually understand these things. And that's the intent of this show. So again, support the sponsors, support the show, and let other people know you got to tune in because this is an educational grassroots show, like I say at the beginning. So what's the next line? What's the next step? Well, we're going up to Federalist Paper number 26, and this one is Alexander Hamilton. And the portion that I'm going to read is out of paragraph 9. Independent of parties in the national legislature itself, as often as the period of discussion arrived, the state legislatures, who will always be not only vigilant, but suspicious and jealous guardians of the rights of the citizens against encroachments from the federal government, will constantly have their attention awake to the conduct of the national rulers and will be ready enough if anything improper appears to sound the alarm to the people, and not only to be the voice, but if necessary, the arm of discontent. What happened? Here they're talking as they understand this contract that they're creating, and the federal government is so limited that they're unable to really, you know, gain the controls. Have we really slept that well at that far off the road at the wheel here that we're just past the point of no return? No. The states have still yet to relinquish their sovereignty of this Constitution. And until they do so, they can step in at any point and say, oh, look at, you know, it's really nice that you were trying to take care of us. And it's really nice that you've been, you know, kind of buying us with all these things that we thought you could do. But now that we're aware and now that we know that you shouldn't be doing this, and we realize from the tyranny that you've applied from the BLM and the Department of Interior and the tyranny that you use with the Department of Energy and so forth and so on, that it's time to say goodbye and shut those things down. We're going to take these things back, and we're actually going to make this republic better, like Donald Trump's slogan, "Make America Great Again." So anyway, clearly Hamilton right here said that it's the states, and it would be, and I'll just read it again because it's that powerful. State legislatures who will always be not only vigilant but suspicious. What happened to our state legislatures? Where's the vigilance and suspicion? And why weren't they jealous guardians over these past centuries in keeping the federal government against these encroachments? Well, history, you know, we can dig through all of this and come to all of the conclusions. Bottom line is that these are encroachments and we got to get them undone. So let me move on because I think, again, knowledge is power, and we're going to get very knowledgeable on this because this wasn't just one, you know, really, you know, flip of the tongue or this, you know, sleight of hand. This is a mountain of empirical data and evidence that these people knew that what they were creating and what the states signed on for was a very limited and defined federal government. So as soon as we come back from this last break, I will be able to get into the next Federalist Paper. So I beg you, please stay tuned. It's a good one. And it's Alexander Hamilton. So stay tuned. Thank you very much. Well, I don't know who that last sponsor was, but I thank them. Now, this next Federalist Paper is, again, Federalist Paper number 31. It's Alexander Hamilton, paragraph 12. And in other Federalist Papers, I think he creates these straw man arguments. And so I want to kind of put this up and frame this for you, that he starts off with what I believe is the straw man argument. And he states, it should not be forgotten that a disposition in the state governments to encroach upon the rights of the union is quite as probable as a disposition in the union to encroach upon the rights of the state governments. So historically, states and sub-governments within a republic, sub-entities within a republic, have been able to get away with shenanigans. However, the capitulation of a society and the downfall of an empire has never really been from those uprisings or small encroachments for the state. It has always been and from the tyranny of centralized government. So let me get back on to what he says. As in republics, strength is always on the side of the people. And as there are weighty reasons to induce a belief that the state governments will commonly possess most influence over them, there is a greater probability of encroachments by the members upon the federal head than by the federal head upon the members. Again, this is that straw man argument that he's reasserting. The safest course to lay them altogether aside and to confine our attention to wholly the nature and the extent of powers as they are delineated in the Constitution. So he's saying, okay, so we're arguing back and forth over these encroachments, but let's put all of that aside and let's look at the powers that are delineated in the Constitution. Because the federal government is held to those delegated powers. They just can't take upon themselves any new power. That's why we have an Article 5 process, that if the government wants any more powers or any new powers, it has to amend the Constitution to be able to exercise that. So I ask you, as we rallied or as I ranted at the beginning of this show over the healthcare, CBO, and everything else, show me in the Constitution the amendment that granted the federal government to oversee and have the controls and regulate our healthcare system. Where did the states surrender this? I'll even give you another one, and you'll love this. If you go back into 1926, you'll find that the federal government attempted to amend the Constitution so that they could ensure and regulate child labor to protect the children. That was their argument in 1926. And they put forth a amendment to the states that the states ratify and grant them and delegate them the power to regulate labor. Well, guess what? The state said, no way. We're not going to let you relegate and dictate to us and control labor, even if it's just child labor, because that's the nose in the tent. So the states were wise at that point in time, and they said no. So what ended up happening is FDR, because who was in office in 1926? Well, that was Coolidge, because Coolidge was going for re-election after taking over from Harding. And so this was his last term in office and when in the election process. And so that amendment went out, but it was not ratified. And yet I believe there's this thing called the Department of Labor. So they knew they had to do that, and they gave us a little breadcrumb trail. But the fact is that there's no amendment to the Constitution that gives them the power and the ability to regulate labor, to sanction unions or not. That's up to the states. And so how do we have a Department of Labor? Well, FDR stacked the courts and got the judges to rule in favor. And as we talk about this next week with Mark Erbach, we're going to talk about how the court system has been used to push this progressive agenda forward and to convince us that they can do all of these things. The least powerful branch within the federal government has been most culpable in doing, and I got to admit that the executive has been a big driver when we've had big progressive executives such as FDR, Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Carter, Clinton, Bush, Obama. Okay, so we've had a lot of progressives in office that have continually grown government. Fact of the matter is that it's all unconstitutional. And, you know, as you're driving home, don't have a car accident over this. We need you to make it home safe, and we need you to join us and get involved. And how can you get involved? Well, support us. Support our sponsors. Let other people know to listen, to download these podcasts, and to start getting involved. I've got an executive summary out there that I'm putting out to state legislatures. I'm giving them the information, giving them the opportunity to act first, to have to avoid the delay in time, to have to do the grass movement side. I'm trying to educate enough people to make sure that our state legislatures know that all they've got to do is audit this contract. That's all they got to do. And basically call out the federal government on all the encroachments. And basically say, you want to do that, amend the Constitution. And oh, by the way, you won't even have 38 states it's necessary, because we got 25 states that say we don't want you to do it. So what do we do? And I'll get into all of that as far as the strategies and plans of all that, because it's in my books. That's another way you can support us, because all the money and the proceeds from my books will go to the paying for the airtime, the educating, and, you know, this little hobby that I have, or if you want to call it that, or my holy war, whatever you want to call it. Buying my books is one way of supporting that. The ebooks are cheap, but if you buy an ebook, most people just can't see just wasting money on an ebook. I would hope that you'd read it. And if you do read it, I would hope that you would give me a review on it. And so I do have quite a few reviews. If you read them, I have no idea who this gal, Shay in Michigan was, but she, you know, commented that my writing was a lot like Hayek and Levin. Mark Levin, but Levin, I guess is how he pronounces it. But anyway, I digress. Let me move on to the next Federalist paper. This one is Federalist paper number 45. You'll notice that I'm using some of the similar Federalist papers, but I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit. But these are literally different paragraphs. And this is paragraph 7 of Federalist paper 45. The state government will have the advantage of the federal government, whether we compare them in respect to the immediate dependence of one or of the one or the other, to the weight of personal influence which each side will possess, to the powers respectively vested in them, as to the predilection and probable support of the people, to the disposition and faculty of resisting and frustrating the measures of each other. In other words, what Madison's saying here is that both kind of have influence over the people. However, the states, because they're the closest, should have the greatest influence over the people. And it seems to me that the reason we've got all these progressives marching in the streets is because they really don't care about the state. And that's why do we keep electing progressives to go into our state government? Because they're basically selling us downriver. It's almost like they'd rather get rid of the Washington State Constitution and just become an administrative head for some global government. And I just shudder to think, you know, that we're just continually voting for and bringing people into power. Even here locally, we've got to get these progressives out. We have to start holding these guys to the oath when they raise their arm to the square and say that they will protect and defend the Constitution. We have to hold them to it, because it is our liberties that is at stake. Because when they discard the Constitution and you think you're going to have the freedom of speech, or you think you'll be able to freely exercise your religion, no. The state will dictate whether that's a threat or not. And I ask you to read Plato's Republic, because the state will control everything, and you will no longer, even though you may have your God-given rights, but those God-given rights can put you in jail, and those God-given rights can kill you, because you will be subjected or enslaved by the state when we surrender our Constitution. Okay, so this next episode, or this next portion of the Federalist Papers, is Federalist Paper number 48. And this is James Madison paragraph 16, and whoop, I'm out of time. So you know what's coming up next week. I've got Mark Erbach coming and this Federalist Paper. Stay tuned, listen to us next week, and thank you so much for your listenership. I really depend on it. Thank you. Bye.